The Guardian.
The Guardian Football Weekly podcast. Coming up.
Football Weekly. All right, so we're a day late. But in today's show, tighter than a pair of 70s soccer shorts, it's the Premier League. At the top, Chelsea and United take it to the wire. At the bottom, Fulham continue to the greatest Cottagers comeback since George Michael. Elsewhere, quality football is back at Eastlands as Zenit St. Petersburg make it to the UEFA Cup final. Abroad, there's title news from Germany, France and Spain, where Sid Lowe talks on the fire sale at Valencia. We look at the World Cup for countries that don't exist and one or two posts, plus, of course, all the drama of the final day in the Championship. That's all in Football Weekly.
This is Guardian Football Weekly.
Well, hello all, and apologies for the delay, but here we are in the company of Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi, Paul.
This is a very low-key intro.
It's a very low-key shirt you're wearing.
It's summer.
It's not, listeners. It's not. It really isn't. Sean, two words to describe Paul's shirt?
Loud. It's horrible. It's garish. It's about 17 different colours.
Two words.
Summer has arrived, I think, and Paul's taken full advantage.
Right. It'll soon be on its way again, if that's the way it's greeted, I'm sure. Raphael Honigstein, by contrast, in top Italian threads and
thank
looking very suave indeed. How are you doing, Raphael?
I think Paul got the shirt from the... what's that word?
I'll tell you where I got it, right?
Okay,
I
tell us where you got the shirt.
Palsy Awareness.
Palsy Awareness, okay.
Yeah, it's one of those charity
shops.
Is it
used in therapy or something? Or what? Anyway, Sean, thanks for rejoining us after about a year's absence.
It's been tough. I've been dealing with budgets and trying to keep you happy and everyone else happy. It hasn't been easy.
Okay.
You and Barry and egos.
A lot of people are asking, what about the pick the score winner? Do they get to come in the pod? Is there some special prize or something?
No.
Well, am I not the pick the score winner?
Are you leading?
I think so.
Right, okay.
The Guardian's one I am.
Are you? Oh, good for you, Paul. Well done.
Not much of a competition.
Now, speaking of top of the table, in the Premier League, we head into the final weekend of the season with both Chelsea and Man United level on points for the first time ever in the Premier League and the first time in any kind of top division in England since, what, 1950-something? I'm getting a nod from Sean Ingle on that.
I've worked out now the word I was looking for.
Right.
I think you got it from the coffin capital of Ghana, that show.
And that was well worth waiting for, Rafa. So now, United beating West Ham last weekend. And talk to me about this, Sean Ingle. Wigan, can they... I guess that's the question. They're level on points. Chelsea are taking on Bolton. Wigan hosts United. Can Wigan stop United?
They can on that pudding of a pitch, but I doubt they will. United normally go to Wigan and win, and I can't see it being that different this time. United have got it all to play for. Wigan have nothing really to look forward to. They've survived. Not many people would have thought that last November, December, and I think United should win that game. But, you know, it's a tricky pitch, and you know, other teams have gone up there and struggled. Arsenal, you know, drew 0-0 up there not that long ago.
I'm just wondering whether the stadium, MC or whatever it's called, at Wigan will put up the Chelsea result if Chelsea do score, just to unsettle United a bit, because I think that could be interesting. I agree that I think United will probably win, but you can just see Chelsea scoring an early goal, and if they're a bit naughty, they'll put up big on the screen or whatever they have there.
But they'll know that. They'll have radios in their dugout. They won't need a screen to flash
up. But if the players, I'm not talking about unsettling Ferguson and the people on the bench, but the players, if they're effectively losing the title at that point, Ferguson's not going to shout it at them. They're going to try and keep it secret.
They're going to take it for granted that Chelsea are going to win anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, but it's difficult psychologically when let's say it's 0-0, 15, 20 minutes, Chelsea are 1-0 up, 2-0 up. It can get quite daunting.
What do you think Steve Bruce's team talk would be? Because there's all these conspiracy theories that him being a former United player, he'd be happy if United won the title. But I think if he wanted to etch himself in United folklore even more, to be the manager that denies United the title would surely strengthen any aspirations he has to being one day United manager.
He'll never be United manager.
No, he won't. But you know the way every former United player who's gone on to be a manager now is invariably linked to Old Trafford. He probably has the aspiration. The best way to put forward his claim would be to get a really significant result against United.
Well, United, of course, with Ronaldo still on fire, another two goals against the Hammers, although they were less than stiff opposition. 40 goals now in all competitions. Absolutely extraordinary. But there you go. We all know about United. We all know about Chelsea too. And Avram Grant, against all expectations, still very much in the running for the Premier League title with Chelsea. Less happy faces amongst the Newcastle team that were beaten 2-0 by Chelsea on Monday, which was one of the reasons that we're a day late, by the way. We thought we'd just wait for that game and then do the podcast. And thank goodness we did. What a wonderful quote this is from Kevin Keegan. Watching Chelsea today, I thought, says Kevin, what can I do next year to get near them? And the truth is there's nothing I can do at all, he said. Maybe the owner thinks we can bridge the gap, but we can't. Motivational stuff from...
It's a man who knows his limitations.
Well, it's a good thing to do, isn't it? This league is in danger, he concludes, of becoming one of the most boring but great leagues in the world. But it is bizarre to see Keegan say there's nothing we can do.
Well, it's true, though, isn't it?
Is it?
Well, unless they get $300 million to spend on the squad over the next 2 years, why should they be able to compete with Chelsea?
I don't think it takes $300 million, but perhaps I'm being naive.
Well, just
like... It does take a lot.
I mean, I think everyone remembers, you know, that United won the first Premier League title back in 92-3. Mm. What they forget is that Villa came second, Norwich third, Blackburn fourth, QPR fifth. Mm. So when Keegan talks about how hard it is, we know it next season it's going to be the same four teams, you know, will be in the top four positions. Between 85 and 95, 13 different clubs finished in the top three. Between 1975 and 1985, 13 different clubs finished in the top three. Now, you know, we seem set for kingdom come to have, you know, four different clubs finish. And so Keegan's right. He called it the most exciting but boring league in the world. And I think that's quite a good description.
Well, Arsenal fans would suggest that it didn't take $300 million for them to make a decent stab at the title this year.
But where did they come from? They've had that Champions League money sloshing around for a while. They've had an exceptionally good manager. They've had an incredible youth system. You know, immediately they buy in players and they slightly underhand from all around the world. But... they've got that. Well, Newcastle really are starting from scratch.
Why? Because they tend to be before they've signed their professional contracts, etc. Yeah. Well, certainly that does upset people in Italy, I don't know, but in other nations. Well, there you go. So Kevin's spot on, is he? Well, Raphael, as a non-English combatant, are you...
I think I made the point before here that when you talk about the dominance of the Premier League or the quality of the Premier League, you invariably always talk about the big four and none look that closely when it goes further down the league. But I think at the same time, you know, no other big league is able to support big four teams like that. So I think that in itself still makes it a lot more interesting than a lot of the other teams, because as some of the players rightly say, you know, there's actually a lot more big games than anywhere else. And you throw in the derbies, the local derbies as well for some of the teams, and it becomes a very, very difficult league to win, despite the fact that the top four are almost in a mini league of their own.
Well, they are in the league. Rafa, can I just ask them? You have good contacts at Chelsea. How is the mood at the camp? Because there's so many egos there that are clashing about. And Avram Grant, for all his, you know, people still don't, you know, respect him particularly, a lot of the fans, but he's always been a pragmatist and he seems to have managed to keep those egos together.
There was for a long time, a real big void and a total breakdown of any sort of hierarchy within the team. And it took a while, but now it almost seems to have taken care of itself. People like Balak have stepped in. Lampard's playing a lot better than he was a few months ago. John Terry has come back very strongly. And, you know, and Balak says, you know, you've got a lot of quality, you've got a lot of experience, and most of the time these players will make the right decisions on the pitch. And they seem to have the strength, and also physically, they seem to be in the best shape compared with all the other teams.
Can I ask, do you think it's the leadership on the pitch that's helped Chelsea get to the Champions League final and, you know, challenge United for the league, or is it leadership off it? Because most Chelsea fans would say it's the former.
You know, it's maybe a bit unfair to sort of belittle Grant in that sense, but I think there is the sense of he left players alone to get on with it.
And, well, I think,
you know,
that's
in
a real
system,
virtue, no?
Well, in a system that they used to, he came in with a sort of reformist agenda of attractive football that went out of the window immediately after a few weeks. He didn't even pay lip service to it anymore. Now they're playing Mourinho's system, but they're playing with a bit more freedom because they know there's no manager behind them shouting at them constantly and then telling them to be 1 centimetre more in their proposed position. There's almost a sense of freedom in you know, in chaos. And it can go both ways, but because individually they're in good form at the moment and players like Balak have really stepped into that void, it's working for them. But I don't think it's a long-term scenario, and I think that's exactly the reason why within Chelsea people looking at the setup for next season don't think it is a viable way to run a club for a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, you mentioned Balak, and he seems to be the player who has benefited the most from the transition from Mourinho to Grant, because with Ashley Cole now being allowed to get further forward, he's actually putting in the sort of crosses that Balak loves getting on the end of and showing off his heading prowess, which he never really did under Mourinho.
Yeah, the heading crossing is a good point, because one point Balak did make privately last season was you had a very unsettled front two. I mean, the wide players next to Drogba were constantly in and out of the team under Mourinho. One day it was Robin and one day it was Joe Cole, Sean Wright Phillips, etc. And he said that they come into games with so much pressure to perform under Mourinho that they invariably tend end up doing the wrong thing, not playing the simple ball back into the box, not crossing it, but trying to take on all the opposition and scoring. Certainly, Robin was always guilty of that, and Ballack went nuts. And when he did make the point, I think he was, he was cast as a moaner, you know, somebody, oh, I'm not getting enough crosses, blah blah. The team has to play better for me. But if he was just making a very simple point, and I think that's changed a lot. Not always for the better. I think, you know, somebody like Joe Cole could still benefit greatly from somebody like Mourinho to tell him actually what to do most of the times, because I think half of the time he doesn't know himself what he's doing out there. But a team has emerged almost by osmosis, by itself, helped by the fact that there are no big decisions to make between formations or people in or out. Grant picks the best players in the formation that they're used to play in, and he gets results that way.
One more point on Chelsea's short angle.
Well, it just reminds me a little bit of Real Madrid, Galacticos under Del Bosque. They would argue and bicker amongst themselves for weeks and weeks and months. And yet, when it gets to the sort of crucial part of the season, Real were very, very good at under Del Bosque of putting things together. And people didn't treat Del Bosque very well. But one thing, he was pragmatic and he was inclusive. And I think perhaps one of the problems with Mourinho is he was very Manichaean. He had this very, you're either for him or against him. And I remember Robin pulled out of one Champions League game, you know, a couple of years ago, and Robin made a cutthroat gesture while pointing at Robin to the journalists.
Now,
you can never imagine, you know, Grant doing that, because, you know, he's brought most of the players that he's fallen out with back into the fold, the likes of Ballack, the likes of Malouda.
Well, it is. I just want to go back for a second to Wigan, because I just remember they had that huge win at Aston Villa. It might have been worth mentioning this at the time.
They're defensively very sound under Bruce. That's one thing
he has done. Flying, aren't they? I mean, what if they can do that at Villa, who Villa were one of the form teams in the Premier League? No, is it science fiction to suggest they can put a spanner in United's work?
I think they'll draw.
But you've been predicting United will win nothing all season, so you're just desperately hoping it'll come true.
Look how they've collapsed.
Now,
I wouldn't call it a collapse.
At all their away games, the last points, as I said they would.
Yeah, no, Champions League final and then top of the league.
Chelsea will win that.
Well, you heard it here first. Meanwhile, down at the bottom, how exciting is Fulham's comeback? As big as... Do you reckon this is a better comeback than West Ham's last year? Is it more of a surprise to see them coming back out of the bottom three?
West Ham perhaps had further to go, but they had Carlos Tevez in... You know, Fulham have got Brian McBride.
Paul Doyle explained.
I never said he was rubbish.
But you know, Fulham really have Brian McBride and Jimmy Bullard that are sort of propelling them forward. Yeah. So I think it's remarkable. And the West Ham, you always thought they had the players, but not the attitude. Fulham, it's, you know, probably the other way around, and yet they've managed to drag themselves out of it.
Well, they've been key, because the great thing Larry Sanchez did was he had the smallest team in the league, but he played long ball stuff. Now with Bullard making brilliant deliveries, McBride and Nevland up front, they've actually got a bit of height. And so that's part of the reason for their revival.
Oh, nice one. Well, they're at Portsmouth on the final day. Reading, who went down again, they are at Derby, and Birmingham will be taking on Blackburn. So that'll be interesting. We'll talk more about that, no doubt, on Thursday. That's pretty much it for part one, though, because we've got so much other stuff to discuss around Europe. So that's coming up in a second or two. Part two, then, and on the line from Madrid, it's Sid. Sid, have you been up to 3 a.m. Dunking yourself in fountains?
Well, not last night, but certainly on Sunday night, I was close to that. It was a very, very late night, yeah.
All right, and it basically looked like, I don't know, Leicester Square on a Saturday night, except without the mass drunkenness.
Oh, there was quite a lot of drunkenness.
Oh, there was, okay.
If there was any problem with that, there was perhaps not as many punch-ups as there are at Leicester Square on a Saturday night, but although there were one or two of those as well, as there always are. It was kind of the normal sort of thing from Real Madrid's celebrations. Lots and lots of fans out there, but the celebration itself, the kind of the formal bit of it, is very, very choreographed, because, of course, in theory, the Real Madrid players clamber all over Cibeles, the statue, the goddess of fertility.
Right.
But in practice, they're not allowed to, so they have to set up a series of contraptions so that Raul and Raul only can go and hang a Real Madrid flag and a Real Madrid scarf on the goddess's neck. Now, last year, that was in the shape of a cherry picker, which was hilariously amusing, because this cherry picker couldn't quite get close enough to the goddess. I was kind of sitting there for ages, this thing jerked back and forwards, trying to get him into place. This year, they built...
What an image.
But yes, quite. This year, they built this long platform up to it, and Raul had a few problems, actually, getting the flag around its neck. In the end, it looked like the goddess was wearing a bib.
Well, there you go. They were having that, quite an extraordinary late comeback, weren't they, Real Madrid, to seal the title?
Yep. They were basically, it was all over, it seemed. Patxi Puñal had scored a penalty, I think that was 84 minutes. They needed to win, so they needed two goals in the final 6 minutes. They actually got two in the final 4 minutes, despite the fact they were down to 10 men with Cannavaro taken off, and effectively actually down to 9, because Gabi Heinze was standing just off the pitch getting treatment for a bleeding hand, and they won it anyway.
Cool. Now, meanwhile, Barcelona, somewhat late in the day, suddenly hit form with a 6-0 thrashing of Valencia. What happened there?
Well worth it, isn't it? Well done, boys. Very good. You can win 6-0 when it no longer matters. Barcelona must be really kicking themselves, because those six goals spread over that game and the previous five games would be enough for them to still be in the title. It's still been a title, and of course would be enough for them to be in the final of the Champions League. They've just been unable to score recently, and suddenly six come along at once. London buses and all that. It was just Barcelona, as happens often with them over the last couple of years. But when they get the first goal, everything else then kind of flows from there, because the other team comes out, they provide a bit of space, and Barca can get behind them. And perhaps also there's something very, very simple here, which is that they were playing against Valencia, who, despite the departure of Ronald Koeman, are still rubbish.
Right. Sid, are they going to go down, do you think, Valencia? Any chance?
There is actually a surprisingly good chance of Valencia going down. Just have a quick look at the table for you. Osasuna third from bottom, obviously the last relegation place, with 40 points. Valencia only on 42. The teams between
three
them and
games
the relegation... Three games to go. Mm. The teams between them and the relegation zone are Zaragoza and Recreativa. Well, on Wednesday night, they play Zaragoza in Valencia, which you would say, well, OK, well, that means that's advantage Valencia. Not really, because Valencia have been absolutely dire at home this year. It's their worst home season in the club's entire history. It doesn't look that good for Valencia, although my sneaking suspicion is, at the moment, is that either Getafe or Recre will go.
Your alter ego wants a word, Sid. Rafael?
Sid, my question is, if Valencia do go down, what happens to all these contracts of these really good players that they have? Are they actually valid for a second division, as it were, or are they free to go completely?
The short answer is what will happen to the contracts is the same thing as will happen to the contracts even if they survive, because the contracts themselves are valid for the second division, but Valencia are in desperate financial crisis and will have to sell virtually all of their good players anyway. David Villa will go.
Where to, Sid?
David Villa, I think, will go to Real Madrid in the end. I think Valencia will have no choice but to sell him to them, even though they're desperate not to sell him to a Spanish club. Villa wants to stay in Spain. Yes, there has been interest from other clubs, amongst them, of course, Spurs and Arsenal, who are both very interested in getting him. But I think he'll end up at Real Madrid. Joaquin Sanchez will leave. Vicente will leave if anybody wants to run a risk on his fitness, because if he does get fit, Vicente, he's a great player. The question is, will he get fit, because he's missed so many games? And Valencia will lose all their players. There's a very simple reason for this. I mean, I say financial crisis, but Valencia had this brilliant idea not long ago. Tell you what, they said, let's sell Mestalla and use the money to build a new stadium in a slightly less expensive part of the ground, of the city, and we'll make loads of money on Mestalla. We'll move to a new ground, which will be even better, and we'll solve all of our crisis at once. Well, there's one very big problem with that, which is that this was the classic, if you like, construction industry trick, which is what Real Madrid, of course, did with their old training ground. But it went horribly wrong for two reasons. Firstly, the construction industry is collapsing in Spain, and secondly, they haven't been able to sell Mestalla. So they've bought a €250 million new ground, and they can't get rid of the old one.
That's bad. That's bad.
Credit crunch.
Now, Rangers centre-back Carlos Cuella, any chance of him making the Spanish team? Ask Divemaster, Sid.
Short answer, any chance? No.
Good, right, okay.
Longer answer, should he have a chance? Yes.
Yes, okay.
The centre-backs are absolutely rubbish.
Any truth in rumours that Diego El Cholo Simeone might take over at Atletico this summer? Ask Helguera.
Well, El Cholo Simeone is someone whose name always pops up with Atletico Madrid. I think this year he's now that he's getting the managerial experience in Argentina and proving that he's not too bad as well, Atletico fans wouldn't mind that at all. But there are two or three candidates, I think, right now that are ahead of him, amongst them Kike Sanchez Flores and right. possibly Gregorio Manzano from Mallorca, but it looks like he's not quite so keen, having seen what a mess Atletico are.
Outstanding stuff, Sid. Any nice plans for the rest of the week before we join you again?
Well, as I say, there's Valencia, Zaragoza on Wednesday night, which I will be going to. I suspect that for the first time in 7 years of writing columns for GU, I might completely and utterly ignore the Barcelona-Real Madrid game.
Wow, of course. They play on Wednesday.
They play on Wednesday. Barcelona will have to give Real Madrid a guard of honour onto the pitch, applaud them onto the pitch. That is the entire Barcelona side, except for two men, Deco and Samuel Eto'o, who very conveniently got themselves yellow cards in the 6-0 win against Valencia at the weekend, which means they don't have to travel to Madrid and have the humiliation of being part of that guard of honour for Real Madrid.
And especially in Eto'o's case, that would be quite a humiliation, no?
Especially in Eto'o's case, because, of course, Eto'o, when they won the league a couple of years ago, because of his various problems with Real Madrid over the years, led a chant of "Madrid, you arsehole, salute the champions."
Right.
So ever since then, when Madrid have won the league, the chant has been "Eto'o, you salute the champions."
Right.
Eto'o has decided he doesn't want to get involved in this. Got a yellow card at the weekend.
Deliberately, yeah?
I think deliberately. And I've always tended to defend Eto'o in the past, but this year his behaviour has been really pretty poor. What a coward. What a complete coward.
Sid, on that note...
I'm just saying, Paul once in interviewed Eto'o, didn't you, Paul? And he was quite brusque.
It's worth looking that up, actually, a small talk interview with Samuel Eto'o. He enjoyed the experience greatly.
I have seen that small talk. He did indeed enjoy the experience greatly, didn't he? And this is one of the amazing things about Eto'o from an interview point of view. If he's in the mood, he can be the greatest interviewee of all time. If he's not in the mood, as he clearly wasn't in the mood for some small talk, he can be probably the biggest prick on earth.
Right. It's one to file alongside Luis Figo, small talk, I would imagine, is it?
By the way, speaking of small talks and Spanish-based players, what a new meaning the Ronaldo small talk has just taken on, by the way, from many, many years ago.
Yes, so remind us of the question you asked him, Merced.
The question was Ronaldo, Kylie or Brittany, to which he presumably would have referred now. Well, I'd rather have Kyle than Kylie, but there we go.
At the time, though, he said both at the same time, didn't he? Quite revealing.
He actually sold himself short, because what he meant was both together and one other, and then discovered there's meat and two veg down there.
Ronaldo, of course, currently with his tail between his legs. Oh, no, that was his date. Right.
Anyway.
Moving on then, Sid. We'll catch up with you again on Thursday if we may. Super. Thanks, Sid.
Cheers.
Bye. All right, then. France. Paul Doyle, France. It's all go at the top of Le Championnat.
Sorry, yeah, it is. I think I mentioned a few weeks ago that we were having a title race for the first time in many seasons. And Lyon are aiding that by losing momentum drastically. The gap is now down to 2 points.
How many games to go?
Two games left. And next week they're at home to Nancy, who are battling to get into the Champions League places, so that won't be easy. They also have the best defence in the league. And now Lyon's problem, suddenly, they've been defensively frail all season, but now they can score. They've only won one of their last five games, so to be coming up against the best defence league, it's poor timing.
Their last five?
Yeah.
What's happened to Benzema?
Benzema, he's still playing well. He's had a slight dip in form. Not that drastic, but basically they're totally dependent on him. Nobody else is looking dangerous at the moment at all. Of course, before that, Lyon are playing in the Cup semi-final tonight. So they're actually on course for the first double in their history. And yet, they're also on course for a crisis. So it's a bit like the Evran Grant situation. Alain Perrin's either going to be a hero or a fool at the end of the season, and quite possibly out of his job either way.
PSG?
PSG drew their big relegation battle at the weekend with Toulouse, so it's still a three-horse race between Toulouse, Lens or PSG are likely going to go down. And what's interesting is Bordeaux, who are 2 points behind Lyon at the top, and on the last day, both Bordeaux and Lyon play away to teams who will probably be fighting relegation.
Wow.
So there's plenty of scope for both of them dropping points.
It's a bit like that in Italy, but you'll have to hang on to hear about that. Should we talk about championships now, Sean Ingle? Award-winning Sean Ingle. Should we mention this? Congratulations to you and your cohorts for your...
Well, it's the Guardian won best sort of sports newspaper and web last week at the Sports Awards.
Right.
So, and next week, we're up for a Sony Award, aren't we? But we won't win it.
Right, OK. Well, Raphael Honigstein. I have in my hand a piece of paper. No, that's not the way to go. Germany, it says, at the top. Three games to play, but Bayern are already top. But they've won. Champion thing.
Hold on. Surely we have to mention the UEFA Cup.
So, all right, well, let's mention it straight away. Go on. They can't be doing much celebrating after that unbelievable 4-0 humiliation. What happened there?
It's a very good question. I mean, they were 1-0 down after 5 minutes. Then they picked themselves up, played again, but conceded a second one. And they went out in the second half. Went again, conceded a third one, and then it was all over. They actually played reasonably well when it came to attacking, but they couldn't take any of the chances, and at the back they looked absolutely catastrophic in terms of level of concentration. It was just not there. And afterwards, very funnily, I thought, they were saying, well, it's the UEFA Cup. I mean, we didn't really want to win it anyway. It's not a problem, you know. We won a double in Germany. You know, you've told us that before the season, would have taken it. It's okay. And Kahn even said, you know, I'm happy this is all over, you know. While he hadn't been talking about anything else but the UEFA Cup before, and said, God wanted us to win the game against Getafe,
right.
All of a sudden, it's like, well, you know, I'm happy I don't have to go to Manchester, horrible place.
Wow. But what did you make of Zenit? Are they absolutely extraordinary then?
They're a funny team because they play very good football. They pass around really beautifully. But I think they're sort of typically Eastern European stroke, almost Spanish in the sense that when things go for them, they play fantastically well.
Mm.
As soon as they concede a goal, they can crumble very quickly. And I understand that's what's happening in the Russian league this year. But also in the first leg against Bayern in Munich, you know, for 45 minutes, Bayern played them off the pitch and should have really led them 3-4-0. But then in the second half, they picked themselves up a little bit and came back into it, and then they were even a better team. So very, very moody side, I'd say. You know, full of quality, but perhaps not a lot of steel in it.
They're playing Rangers, of course, who have won headlines all over Europe, I think, with their performance away to
It's astonishing.
Fiorentina.
I don't think a team ever in the history of European competition has set out to play for penalties in the first leg of a two-legged game and succeeded.
It's even in the group stages.
Well, they've won 4 out of 14 games in Europe this season. Right. It's astonishing they managed to get fair play to them.
Absolutely, but, fair play to them, but it wasn't the prettiest.
No,
it wasn't. Well, anyway, they'll be taking on Zenit. But coming back to Germany then, so Bayern Munich are the champions, as expected, ahead of Werder Bremen. 3 games still to play, though. So how many Champions League places are there for the Germans?
3.
Yeah,
and that's really the big talking point as far as the rest of the season is concerned, apart from relegation, of course. Who will get in? I mean, Bremen have done enough, despite having, by their standards, quite a terrible and traumatic seasons in many respects. But the sheer quality within the squad has seen them through. That third spot, very much up for grabs. Hamburg have been playing very inconsistently. Schalke grinding out results without playing well at all. And Stuttgart, despite, you know, going as if they going down at one stage, they played so badly in the first half of the season, suddenly again making a late push and having a bit of momentum. So and Bremen, of course, are playing Hamburg on Wednesday night. So it's a very, very big game, apart from being the Northern Derby and love lost there. So it's actually a very interesting end of the season, but unfortunately, as far as the neutrals are concerned, Bayern with a stop-start finish, first from the first match day until the last. Yes, I don't think it was a major surprise that they won the league quite comfortably.
Oh, indeed not. Well, thank you very much, Raphael. Now, still to come, the Championship. What a dramatic final day there. Playoffs still to come. Of course, the latest from Serie A and from that World Cup of Unrecognised Nations. Big qualifying match played this week in the arena in Milan between Tibet and tough tackling Tibet, I imagine. They get stuck in those Tibetans. I don't know why I'm laughing about that, but they're taking on Padania. More on that in a little bit. Sean's just getting excited about the idea of doing a small talk with Fabio Capello.
You're speaking to him later today, James.
That's the plan anyway. In my more immediate future, some Championship chitter-chatter, an extraordinary final day of the English second tier. The verdicts: West Bromwich Albion and Stoke are up. Hull, Bristol City, Palace and Watford in the playoffs. Going down, meanwhile, Leicester, along with Scunthorpe and Colchester. Sean?
No, I'm just thinking apropos of nothing. I remember not so long ago you could get the Midland Main Line train up to Sheffield and you could have several teams that were in the Premiership. It'd stop off at Luton, it'd stop off at Leicester,
yeah.
It'd stop off at Derby, right. and then Sheffield.
Right.
And there's none of those Midland Main Line teams now are in the Premiership, and you've only got a couple in the Championship. Luton are now in League Two, and Leicester, unbelievably, for a side that, you know, was winning the League Cup less than a decade ago, are now in League One.
Well, indeed, and their misery set to continue. Apparently, Milan Mandarić deciding to he's had enough of it.
He is. Yeah, that's what he's talking about. And I don't know if anyone's ever been to Leicester, but there's always a good support there, and they're big crowds. And it's a shame, really, they've gone down. But they're just making the journey that Wednesday and Man City have made over the last few years. They've spent too much and fiddled about with managers and players and paying the price.
Mm. Stoke, is the Premier League ready for them?
Well, are Stoke ready for the Premier League? Because their success over the last two seasons has been based on a lot of loan signings.
Right.
So they're going to have to completely revamp their squad in the space of 3 months, whatever, before the
start of
the season.
Oh, because I was reading about how they got lots of Premier League experience, but they won't have those players anymore, or what?
Well, they'll have some of them.
It'll be interesting to see how their long ball, tough, let's run and chase and harry all day, day works. I think they'll go straight
works
back
well
down.
For Chelsea.
Well, the Premier League experience is people like Liam Lawrence and Ricardo Fuller. It's not experience of succeeding in the Premier League.
Oh, dearie me. Well, there you go. We got the playoffs coming up this week. Anyway, so we'll be talking more about that on Thursday, Sean.
No, I think it's really interesting that you've got teams like Bristol City and Watford who've barely been able to string a win together for the last 2 or 3 months have both made it. And you've got Palace, I think we should talk about them, a remarkable charge up the league. They're in the relegation zone, you know, around Christmas time. Them and Hull, I think, are the two form teams, and that would make for a good playoff final if they both get there.
Well, looking forward to that then. Now, in Italy, big weekend, of course, and all sorts of movement in the title race because the big game was the Milan derby at the San Siro. Milan won. A fantastic performance from them. They finally kind of reawakened. One last burst of glory, perhaps, from this ageing squad. But Kaká, back to fitness, was great. Patrick Vieira for Inter was awful. And it was a 2-1 win for Milan. Inzaghi getting his 9th goal in 5 games. That 35-year-old, is heading towards the Euro Championships.
And Milan are fourth now, and Fiorentina are tumbling down.
Well, they've
sadly.
Gone down to fifth, they have. But in the meantime, Inter's lead at the top is down to just 3 points. Roma beat Milan's rivals for fourth place, Sampdoria, away at Sampdoria. It was a very big result for Roma, of course, without Totti. Brilliant goal in that from Pizarro. But as you say, the whole fourth place thing looking very, very interesting. And Kaká, his quote after the game, saying, you know, we didn't want Inter claiming the title against us, which is what they would have done had they won. But we also obviously want to maintain our charge for fourth place. They've moved into the top four now with two games to go. But the title race, Inter have to play Siena next weekend, and then they're away to Parma on the final day, Parma battling against the drop. Roma have Atalanta at home, then they're away to Catania, who equally are one of the relegation strugglers, although slightly better placed than Parma are. So it does look like going very much to the final day, this one.
If it finishes level on points, is it decided by goal difference or is it a playoff?
No, they used to have playoffs and they don't anymore. It's either goal difference or head-to-head. I think it's head-to-head results.
In
which case, Inter would, thanks to Zanetti's late goal, would have the edge on that one because they hammered Roma away and then Zanetti earned them. Sorry, Raphael.
No, I've just got a question for you about Inter because they're obviously talking to a lot of players. One of them certainly is Alex Klebb.
Mm.
And I was just wondering if the succession of Mancini has been sorted out yet. Is Mourinho confirmed or what's happening there?
It's interesting because Moratti, the Inter owner, still says that Mancini can stay if he wants. And Moratti's not the kind of guy, he's usually quite a straight, he bats quite a straight bat. But it is true to say that he did meet with Capello behind Mancini's back a couple of years ago before the Calciopoli scandal erupted. So he's not averse to, you know, conducting one set of negotiations behind doors and then taking an entirely different line in public. Mancini, though, this derby does seem to be another nail in his coffin because whilst I mentioned that Vieira was awful and the whole team didn't play particularly well, Mancini has been fingered by the press as the culpable one. He's been described as inept, too defensive, lacking imagination, and the whole team just kind of sat back and defended.
I mean, I've watched a fair bit of Italian football this season, and Inter have really impressed me.
No.
It speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Especially in the big games. You look at the Liverpool game when they absolutely had to do something in the return. They had to just go for it. And again, he basically has this very cautious approach against Valencia in the Champions League. So the knives are anyway are out for Mancini, who always does seem to blow the big games. Milan, meanwhile, also announcing the arrival of Flamini for next season. Whilst it's true that Arsenal players, when they leave Arsenal, don't always perform that well, viz. Patrick Vieira, I think a lot of people are saying he is going to be an absolutely brilliant signing for them.
He's leaving at the right age, isn't he? Often.
Was he 23, 24?
Yeah, 24? I mean, often they're in their 30s before Arsenal let them go, the important players. Where will he play for them? I mean, who will he replace?
In Gattuso's place when he goes to Bayern Munich. Is that the story, Raphael?
That's certainly the story in Germany. Of course, Bayern were one of the two teams that offered Flamini big money as well, but my understanding is that Flamini's on €4 million net at Milan, which is the equivalent of €8 million in, more or less €8 million anywhere else, plus a sign-on fee. So, you know, when Wenger said, he might still stay, it was not the whole truth.
He's done well, hasn't he, seeing as Wenger was going to loan him to Middlesbrough at the start of the season. He's certainly come a long way.
It's a shame that Kevin McCarra's not here because we always talk that point about Arsenal and whether their finances are perhaps not as clear-cut as they look, because Wenger made the point, you know, we have €360 million pounds debt, we have to be careful. I heard from very reliable source what sort of money Flamini was on for 4 years, and I can tell you all the official figures that were quoted, about €20,000, they are so far out that you would not believe it. I mean,
he was just on
so little money. Well, let's say
the 20 grand
a week was half right. The figure's right, but not the week.
Zeros. Oh, I see. No way. My word. Away. That's extraordinary. So, and what about the Gattuso to Bayern?
It looks as if it's on the card.
Right,
certainly,
Milan are still denying it.
Klinsmann has sort of given his okay. He's in Munich right now, talking to Bayern about next season. They feel they need somebody experienced to hold that team together in the front of midfield because Van Bommel can't do it on his own. And Zé Roberto, who's played in that position, is 34 next year. And they're looking at somebody to be a bit destructive and a bit nasty. And Van Bommel is not enough for them in terms of nastiness, so they want Gattuso now.
And is there a sense that, because Luca Toni has talked about wanting more Italian players up to alongside alongside him. Is this going to be the first of many Italians, or first of one or two, do you think?
Well, I think two things have happened. Certainly, from a social point of view, Luca Toni would like another Italian there. He said that to Bayern. And also, you know, Luca Toni's manager and people in Italian football have told other Italians how much money Bayern are actually paying. And all of a sudden, you know, people think, that's
how
not
much
so
is Luca Toni on? He's the best paid in the Bundesliga, isn't
Well,
he?
At the moment, in terms of pound euro conversion rate, he'd be the best Premiership player. He's on 10 million euros, £8 million a year.
Just letting that one
154,000
as much as you,
154,000 pounds a week.
My word, my word. Well, there you go. Fascinating stuff, Raphael. Otherwise, anyway, so there you go. You've got a very exciting finale coming up then with Inter and Roma duelling away, and Milan finally now back in the top four. We had another one of those white draw games where somebody scored a late winner and opposition team members chased him the length of the pitch for some reason, which they're now having an inquiry about, and nothing will really happen. But I was curious to notice that tomorrow night in Milan, in the arena, which is basically an old Roman amphitheatre, which has been converted into a bit of a football stadium. They use it for athletics, and Inter used to play there back in the 20s. It's a lovely place. If you ever go to the centre of Milan, it's just, I think, north of the centre, and it's a proper Roman arena, and they've just built a bit on top, and lovely place. But they're going to have, it'll be packed out tomorrow night because the Padania national team, Padania is the northern region of Italy, which with the Northern League re-entering the government a couple of weeks back with lots of enthusiasm and apparently 300,000 armed supporters ready to lay down their lives for the cause, according to Umberto Bossi, Padania is very much back on the agenda, and their national team, led by one Maurizio Gans, don't know if you remember him from Milan and Inter and that, great player, will be taking on Tibet on Wednesday night there as part of qualifying for the World Cup of Unrecognised Nations.
Tibet with a mountain to climb there?
Oh dear. But it is interesting. This is going to take place between the 7th and the 13th of July in Lapland, who are another, I think they're actually the holders, and they are they're another unrecognised nation. Not sure how you qualify for that. They don't have a Starbucks or something like that, I think is the thing. But there's an organisation called the New Football Board, or the Nouvelle Football Board, which organises this thing. Zanzibar are the top rated unrecognised nation in the world. Provence, who sickeningly have still not been recognised as an independent state.
But how can you become? But my question is, how can you become a recognised, unrecognised?
Oh, I see. How can
nation?
You? I think
I mean, anyone.
If
could
Provence
be,
is yeah. in there, I'm thinking they'll take anybody. Really, who else is there? West Papua. How about this? Gozo. You know that little island off Malta with 30,000 people?
No.
They're in there. Okay. Monaco.
Have the pod enter a team?
Probably could, actually. Lapland, Padania, Kurdistan, Gozo, West Papua, Monaco, some of the teams that will be hoping to make it to Lapland for the... Cornwall. I wonder if they... Is there a Cornwall team? Sean, do you know about that?
I know nothing.
Well, that's a surprise from you, Sean Ingle. And on that note, I think we'll probably conclude today's instalment from the front line of football mondial. We will be back on Thursday, which is only 2 days' time, worryingly, with a look forward to the weekend and that big Premier League showdown, of course. In the meantime, Raphael, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Another fascinating contribution from you, Sean Ingle. Delighted to see you again.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, Sean. And Paul Doyle.
Thanks, James.
All right. Well, thank you. And producer Camby. Can't forget him. And you, the listener, for making it all possible. Bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.